claims that law must be colorblind, or that the datum of race is no longer relevant to public policy, must be seen as aspiration rather than as descriptive of reality.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast. My name is Elise Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Sproul.
For episode 2 of our series on affirmative action, we have a conversation waiting for you with Professor Jonathan Macer of the University of Chicago Law School. And well, Professor Macer is just a generally awesome and super smart person. We're going to specifically be talking about his study with Justin Driver, Kyle Rosma, and Adam Shilton on the empirical benefits of diversity on the law review journals at law schools. So we're going to move quickly into that interview, but first we're going to talk a little bit about the diversity rationale and give some background on the basis of Professor Macer's study.
Okay, so the diversity rationale. In our introduction episode, we mentioned that affirmative action originated as this means to rectify past harms, kind of a form of reparations for the United States history of racial discrimination and resulting inequities.
However, we also discussed how Justice Lewis Powell, when he wrote this sort of compromise, kind of on his own opinion in Regents of the University of California versus Bakke, he abandoned the reparations argument in favor of a less widely advanced diversity argument, basically that schools and students benefit from having students with a wide range of experiences and perspectives on their campus.
That's kind of just the idea that we call the diversity rationale. And it's been embraced on multiple occasions by the Supreme Court as the only reason why affirmative action is constitutionally acceptable. So that argument saying that, hey, the United States committed all these horrible acts of racism in the past, and that's led to these historic inequities, particularly in higher education, isn't enough to have affirmative action. But in conservative social and cultural circles, the diversity rationale and diversity often gets slammed as resulting in less meritorious students and alumni. One comes at the expense of the other, they say.
So it's weird because the diversity rationale, honestly, I don't feel like anyone really likes it because conservatives are like, no, we don't like diversity is making applicants less meritorious and these people haven't earned admission to these schools. And then liberals are often like, yeah, diversity is great, but we should want to do affirmative action not just because it increases diversity, but because it's the right thing to do and it'll help resolve inequities in our society. But let's talk quickly about the kind of conservative claim of applicants being less meritorious. So an often cited example is that former President Barack Obama was the president of the Harvard Law Review in 1990. Decades later, however, especially when he was running for president, observers claimed that Obama's time as president of the Law Review coincided with a notably weak year for the Law Review Journal in terms of citations. So how many times did a court or someone else cite an article that the Law Review chose to publish? In doing so, Macer and his colleagues wrote, they were implicitly saying that by selecting a Black student as president of the Harvard Law Review, the editors had sacrificed quality in order to gain diversity.
Come on, literally any high school senior, a few days as we're recording this before early applications are due, can tell you that more diverse candidates and more candidates in general for something results in it being more difficult to actually gain acceptance to that program or whatever, because you're competing at a higher level. But for the sake of the argument, sure, whatever. So Professor Macer and his colleagues investigated how implementing diversity policies on law review journals actually impacted their success, quantitatively how many times their chosen articles were cited. He, Professor Dryman, Rosema, and Chilton examined 13,000 articles published over the course of 60 years to find that law reviews with diversity policies saw median citations to their volumes increase by about 23% in the 5 years after. This is very important as someone in advanced statistics.
Yeah, that's a huge finding, a major result. And it's important to recognize how much work they put into that. We will talk more with Professor Mazur about the incredible journey that he went on to get these findings. But we'll also talk about exactly what their finding means for legal, social, and cultural arguments for and against affirmative action. So let's jump into that conversation right now.
We are so lucky to be joined today by Professor Jonathan Mazur of the University of Chicago Law School. He teaches in behavioral law, finance, economics, and he recently co-wrote Assessing Affirmative Action's Diversity Rationale in the Columbia Law Review with our favorite Justin Driver, Adam Chilton, and Kyle Rosma. We are so excited to pick his brain on the diversity rationale and other exciting affirmative action questions. Professor Mazur, thank you so much for joining High School SCOTUS. And because this is my favorite question, I'll ask the first question, which is, what were you like in high school?
Thanks very much for having me. I was a big nerd in high school. I was actually sort of like an orchestra nerd. I played in orchestra and lots of my friends were in the orchestra. So like that was kind of my crowd, was the orchestra folks. And I went to high school long enough ago that being a nerd was kind of uncool. But in the intervening years, the world has shifted around me. And also I now am surrounded by many bigger nerds. So now like being a nerd is very cool.
I still think being a nerd is not cool. Just to clarify, Hannah and I have a lot of experience with that.
Maybe here at the University of Chicago is the sort of nexus for cool nerddom. And so my horizons have shifted. But I guess the lesson is, if you're a big nerd or if you're big anything, like just go to the place where that thing is cool. And so that's what I've succeeded in doing.
That is the game plan. Okay, so what got you interested in the topic of affirmative action?
It was actually a lawsuit that was filed against the Harvard Law Review and the NYU Law Review, accusing them of violating a variety of statutory provisions and also violating the Constitution because they had diversity programs for their membership. And so those are student-run journals that publish legal scholarship. I've published pieces in the NYU Law Review in the past. And my co-authors and I started talking about how we thought these lawsuits were meritless. And also these lawsuits were making claims that we thought we could actually empirically test. And what we realized as we sort of talked about it was that this was much bigger than just talking about student-run law reviews. This was about actually being able to find a way to test whether diversity matters in higher education, which is obviously a question of enormous importance, importance to the Supreme Court, importance to colleges and universities, importance to people generally. And so we thought this is our window in, this is our way of figuring out quantitative way to assess whether diversity is important.
So I'm a big fan of legal empiricism generally. But we also want to hear some anecdotal evidence about whether you've seen or been witness to someone really benefiting from affirmative action, particularly in higher education.
Well, I should say, I mean, I can't know whether anyone has benefited from affirmative action in particular, affirmative action meaning a program meant specifically to encourage diversity. I don't know what goes into the secret sauce of our admissions office when people are admitted. So when I see a student, I have no idea. I don't know that student's test scores. I don't know their undergrad GPA. I don't know anything about them. So I have no way of knowing for whom affirmative action mattered and for whom it didn't, which I think is good. I think it's really good that I come to all of my students with a completely blank slate and my impressions are formed just based on my own experiences with them. But diversity, on the other hand, so just to give you an example, I teach a seminar every year on behavioral law and economics, and it's 20 people sitting in a room talking, and I let the students do most of the talking about all kinds of different legal issues. We talk about credit cards and consumer finance. We talk about workplace employment discrimination. We talk about sort of politics and political culture. And it's crucial that the people in that room bring different perspectives and different life experiences to that conversation. It's a really poor conversation. It's a thin conversation when everyone thinks the same way, everyone has come from the same background. But when I look out at my class and I have a class of 20 different people coming from different places, I just know like we're gonna have a really rich and interesting discussion. And so I see the value of diversity in my classroom on a daily basis.
Right. So your classroom kind of displays the qualitative effects of affirmative action, but then you wanted a way to quantitatively measure whether that was actually true in other places and also maybe could be extended to the classroom setting.
Exactly. I mean, there are lots and lots of testimonials and sort of qualitative descriptions of the value of diversity in higher education. Endless numbers of them. But that's not satisfying to some people. Some people want to see numbers. And numbers are really hard to come by because, like, how do you measure whether a university is doing a better job in a particular year by virtue of being more diverse? How do you measure the knowledge output of a university? Or, like, if you have a class where people are graded on a curve, how do you measure whether that class is learning more or learning less in a given year in a quantitative way? So quantitative assessments are very hard to come by. And a lot of the critics of affirmative action have seized on that fact and said, because you haven't been able to measure this quantitatively, we don't believe it. We don't think it has a strong empirical foundation. We don't really trust it. And so that's exactly where our study was meant to intervene, what we were trying to get at.
We're going to jump track a little bit because we want to talk about the legal precedent that played a role in your study and break it down for our listeners. But we were hoping that you could tell us about Odegaard and how it was the court's kind of first invocation of the diversity rationale.
Well, that's the first case where the court sort of brings up the diversity rationale. But the case that really, if you'll permit me for skipping ahead a tiny bit, the case that really matters is Bakke versus the Regents of the University of California. So that's a 1978 Supreme Court case. And it was challenging California's affirmative action program. And I think the thing that's really important to understand about that case in 1978 was that there were a lot of different arguments that were advanced in defense of affirmative action. And in fact, some of affirmative action's strongest supporters, including the University of California at the time, said the reason why we need to have affirmative action is to advance racial justice. The history of the country is a history of oppression of racial minorities, and we need to do something about that, and affirmative action is a way to do something about that. That view only got 4 votes on the Supreme Court. There was another view that was just that affirmative action was unlawful. That view also got 4 votes. And so it was just one single person, Justice Lewis Powell, who wrote this separate opinion in which he embraced the diversity rationale. And that opinion, just for himself, has become one of the most important Supreme Court opinions, certainly in the last 50 years, if not in sort of modern history. Number one, I mean, it made the diversity rationale the only constitutional reason for having affirmative action. And number two, it really changed the way that we talk and think about affirmative action generally. Like if you ask university administrators or educators, or if you ask students, if you just talk to your classmates and you talk to them about like, why is it important to have affirmative action programs? They're all going to say diversity. It changed the way we think about it as a society. And I think that there are actually good and bad aspects of that. I happen to believe that affirmative action would have been justified as a means of trying to move towards racial justice, and that redressing some of the racial harms of the past was a good reason for allowing affirmative action as well. But that opinion by Justice Powell and Bakke took all of that off the table and made diversity the only game in town.
That's so strange that one justice, merely because he was the swing justice, could go off on a whim and say, we're just going to totally shift gears and talk about diversity now, even though no one was thinking about it until he decided that this was the way that he was going to get 5 votes. And I find that crazy. It almost reminds me of the whole ACA case where Justice Roberts just decides we're going to pretend like it's a tax or whatever, and then now everyone's on board. It's just like so strange that one person can have so much sway over a whole body of law.
Right. It is really remarkable. It wasn't quite a whim. You know, other people had been suggesting it. And as Hannah indicated, the idea had come up in previous cases. Harvard University wrote a brief in that case suggesting the diversity rationale. The United States Army had written briefs suggesting that the diversity rationale was important. But it's true that he was just one person. He only wrote for himself. He didn't even get 5 votes on his opinion. He just got himself. And yet, because he was right smack in the middle, it became incredibly important. I think it just goes to show, if you have a voting body of only 9 people, like the Supreme Court, the person who's right in the middle, that 5th person, becomes incredibly important. And as you said, with the ACA case and with other things, we've seen that over and over again.
So continuing to move forward in time a little bit, also talking about very specific justices, we wanted to ask about Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and how she defended affirmative action in Grutter versus Bullinger.
Right. So that's a 2003 case about the University of Michigan. And one thing that's interesting in that case is that there were 2 different programs that were being challenged, one run by the University of Michigan itself, and one run by the University of Michigan's law school. And the University of Michigan's program had very specific numbers attached to it and kind of numerical targets, like this is the kind of class we're trying to create. The University of Michigan's law school was just using race or ethnic background as a plus factor. It was like a thumb on the scale in their admissions process. That was a little more sophisticated by virtue of being a little more subtle. And maybe that's because it was a law school and they sort of knew what to expect from the court. But the Supreme Court strikes down the University of Michigan's, the college's plan, but upholds the law school's plan. And in that case, and I think this is probably the famous thing you're alluding to, Justice O'Connor says it's still important to have affirmative action to encourage diversity now. Diversity is still this is the technical language of the opinion, it's still a compelling governmental interest that allows Michigan to use race in its admissions process. It's not going to be necessary forever, and maybe in 25 years, it will no longer be necessary. So Justice O'Connor sort of set a ticking clock starting in 2003, presumably ending in 2028. I think we can think about what has changed in our country between 2003 and today. I think the country has made a lot of progress along racial lines. I think the progress is undeniable, but I think it's also undeniable that we have a long ways to go yet. And so a lot of people have said, you know, that 25 years was sort of aspirational, like it's really going to take more than 25 years. But in any event, here we have the Supreme Court maybe short-circuiting that by 5 or 6 years.
Right. So the headliner with the Justice O'Connor said that affirmative action could expire eventually. But I wanted to ask quickly about how she delineated between we can use the diversity rationale when it's a vague plus factor, but we can't use the diversity rationale if it's a quota or if it's like we need to achieve a certain number of underrepresented students in our classes. So why did she decide that that was where she was going to draw the line? And can we or should we put a number on the amount of diversity you need in a school?
Yeah, the court, I think, has been sort of consistent about this all along, but never for reasons that are well explained. And I guess the way I would describe it is that the court is uncomfortable with saying, here are a certain number of spots set aside for white people, here are a set number of spots set aside for Black people, here are a number of spots set aside for Asian Americans, or that sort of thing, or anything that looks too deterministic, where it looks like you're just sort of being made to fill a particular spot that's designated for you. And I guess, you know, why exactly that should be unconstitutional, whereas just sort of a plus factor should be constitutional, the court hasn't done a good job of really explaining it. I guess maybe one way to think about it is the court feels squeamish about the use of race. The court is uncomfortable. The court has been made uncomfortable by the overt use of race. And so they're willing to tolerate it when it's just one factor of many and it's kind of mixed in with other things and you never really know, was race determinative in this particular case? Was it just a piece of it? But when it looks like people are being sorted into racial categories or race is being used in a determinative way, then the court thinks like that's too overt, it's too obvious, and that runs afoul of their sensibilities. There is no obvious constitutional reason for distinguishing those things. It's more of a sort of a feeling about how central the role of race is versus how important the need is for the institution. So I think the court's kind of saying, we understand that you need to consider race to some degree, but you can do it as long as it's not totally central, because when it becomes totally central, that's a bridge too far.
So sticking with the diversity rationale, do you feel that it's a satisfying justification that over time, because we've mentioned a lot about race, but our definition of diversity is kind of different than just race now, from geographical, socioeconomic, and gender diversity and racial diversity. So has that definition changed over time, that everyone brings something that someone else might not offer?
I think that that's right. And I think that a lot of institutions are talking about diversity as spanning many, many different dimensions, just as you said, spanning dimensions of gender, certainly, dimensions of ethnicity, dimensions of class also. I think it's important that not everyone come from wealthy, privileged families at an institution. People from other backgrounds lend a lot of perspectives. Diversity of experience in one's family. In law schools, we talk a lot about first-generation law students, first generation professionals, first people in their family to hold sort of professional jobs. I think that form of diversity is important. So I think that institutions of higher education have become more sophisticated over time about thinking about diversity along all these many different dimensions. Whether they're doing a great job of actually achieving diversity along all those dimensions is a different matter. I think that if you look at a school like Harvard, the subject of this lawsuit, Harvard is doing a better job of achieving racial diversity than it is of achieving class diversity. The majority of people admitted to Harvard still come from relatively privileged, wealthy backgrounds, at least, let's say. So I think schools are doing a better job of thinking about that. One thing that's important here is that if you decide that you want to try to admit some people from sort of socioeconomically underprivileged backgrounds, you want people in your class who didn't come from family wealth, that doesn't really raise constitutional problems. If you say you want to have gender diversity, that raises smaller constitutional problems. The hackles of the Supreme Court and sort of the real constitutional sticking point is invoked when you're talking about race in particular. So race, I think, is the kind of central sticking point in these cases because it's the issue that most squarely is involved with the Constitution. But that's not to say that other forms of diversity are not important as well. And I think that universities are doing a good job of understanding that.
It's interesting that you bring up that race is such a larger concern than these other methods of discerning who you're going to let into your school, even though it's kind of the same thing. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I do. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, the reason, of course, is it's just the way that our laws are written. The Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution was in particular to try to guarantee equal protection of the laws to non-white people in America, because those are the people who've been subjected to unequal treatment previously. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which is the other legal provision at issue in this case, it prohibits race discrimination. It doesn't prohibit socioeconomic discrimination. It doesn't prohibit geographic discrimination. So we have laws that were meant to try to equalize treatment between people of different races. And of course, those laws are now being turned around and used against affirmative action programs that involve race in some way. So I think it's at least arguable that race is simultaneously the issue in the country where we need to do the most work, but also the issue that raises the greatest legal problems because of the way these provisions are written and because of the country's history.
So as we've talked about, you recently published your study attempting to empirically observe the benefits of diversity policies in higher education. So walk us through why you chose to study law reviews as a microcosm for how diversity negatively or positively impacts higher learning, whether you think that's applicable and can be extended to law schools in general or perhaps even undergraduate institutions.
Yeah, so these student-edited law journals have two big advantages for purposes of studying them. One advantage is they function a lot like higher education functions generally. So what we have are groups of students, usually anywhere between 5 and 15, who are reading scholarly articles written by faculty and deciding which of them they want to publish, and then deciding which of them are the most important and the most valuable. And then once they've decided which to publish, editing them, giving comments on them, trying to improve them. And that work, which is sort of done collaboratively, it's a lot like the work of learning in the classroom generally. It's students talking to each other, working in groups, trying to analyze a piece of writing, decide whether the piece of writing makes good arguments or bad arguments, whether it's interesting and new or not interesting and not new, whether it holds together and is logically coherent, that kind of thing. Like, it's all the same kind of reasoning that you get just in the process of learning in any other class generally. Not to mention, it's the same kind of thinking you get when it's 11 o'clock at night and students are hanging out in the lounge and chatting before class the next day. So what the students are doing on those law journals looks a lot like what students are doing in higher education as a general matter. And the second thing is that these law journals offer a quantifiable metric by which we can judge how well the students are doing. And it's the number of citations to their articles. So they choose to publish someone's article, like maybe one of these journals publishes my article. What they want is for my article to have an impact on the rest of the legal academy, the rest of law schools. And they can measure whether my article has had an impact based on whether people cite my article or not. And so you've got a process that looks like higher education that generates a quantifiable, measurable outcome. And that makes it a really sort of fertile ground for studying whether increasing diversity benefits the students.
Right. That totally makes sense. So walk us through then as well the process for students getting on law reviews. Is it an election or is it diversity policy? Like, how does that become a way that you can measure something similar to the effect that affirmative action has in higher education?
Yeah, different schools do it a little bit differently here and there. First of all, it's student run. The students make their own decisions about who to invite to join these journals. But usually speaking, it's some combination of your law school grades from your first year. So there's a grade component and your performance on a writing test that they administer typically during the summer between your first and second years. So there's a grade component and a test component, which looks a lot like how people get into college, a grade component and like an SAT type of thing, or how they get into law school, a grade component and the LSAT. And then those two things get kind of combined somehow. And then some schools also have affirmative action programs of various types. And so all of that information, the first year grades, the performance on this writing test, and if they have a diversity program, sort of those considerations all get put into the journal's like little secret sauce. And then that generates a list of the people they want to invite to join the journal the next year. And the thing that really matters for us, and the thing that made our study possible, was that different law journals instituted diversity policies in different years. So they didn't all have them from the beginning of time. They didn't all start them in the same year. Just particular journals would start them in particular years. So like, let's suppose we have a journal that started a diversity program in the year 2010. We can look at how that journal was doing. How many citations were that journal's articles getting in the years before it started the diversity policy compared to its peer journals? And then in the years after it instituted the diversity policy compared to its peer journals. And that comparison, like how are you doing against your peers before and after, that can tell us something about whether the diversity policy helped or harmed that journal.
That's really interesting. I wanted to ask if there was any way that you could debrief overall your findings from that study, because we think they're really interesting.
Sure. I'll try to explain exactly what we found. So first of all, I guess I want to say this is a part of the study that I was responsible for in large part, and I find it sort of amusing. So I'll relate it very quickly. But figuring out what year each journal instituted its diversity policy was a little bit tricky. Sometimes it gets written up in a newspaper, like occasionally the New York Times will report about a journal or another that's instituting a diversity policy, but lots of times it doesn't. And so we actually just found the names of the students who were in charge of these journals, sometimes dating back 20 or 30 years. And we had to like reach out to them. I would send cold emails or cold call these people and say, hey, I'm a law professor. You've never heard of me, but I'm doing the following study. And will you talk to me about your time as editor-in-chief of the Penn Law Review in the year 1990? These are people who are way into their other careers. The ways in which I went and found these people was sometimes remarkable. There's one person who left law entirely and became a cardiologist. And I called his hospital and got him on the phone at his hospital. And I mean, he's like been a doctor for 25 years. He hadn't been a lawyer in a long time. There was another person who I could find his mailing address, but not his email address or phone number. So I actually wrote a physical letter and sent it to him, which is like the first time I think I've sent a stranger a physical letter in a decade or something like that. And he actually responded. It was amazing. So anyway, so we tracked down all of those dates and we look at each journal compared to its peers. And what we find is that journals that institute diversity policies see a 25% increase in their citations in the years following the institution of the diversity policy. 25%. That's a pretty big number, all things considered. You know, these journals are like really struggling to get the best articles. They're struggling for every little edge. So to have your citations go up 25% is really remarkable. And our hypothesis is that's because having a more diverse group of voices in the room allows the journal to do a better job at figuring out which articles are good and which make sense and which are logically coherent. They're able to look at those articles and say, hey, that article makes sense. I know because I have this perspective, or I have this argument that you haven't thought of as to why this article is bad or something like that. And they're just doing a better job at that. And one last thing, I'll tell you one more little piece of this. You might think that the types of articles that the journal publishes would change. Law is a really big field. You know, there are some people who write about constitutional law, some people write about criminal law, but other people write about tax law or corporate law or patent law or you name it. And so you might think, well, maybe the journals are just changing the types of articles they publish because they have different members who care about different things. And we checked that, actually. We thought that might be an important factor to consider. And we found they really don't. The types of articles they publish before the institution of their diversity policy and the types of articles they publish after the institution of their diversity policy are basically identical. And so what that means is that they're picking the same types of articles, they're just picking better articles. They're doing a better job of it. And that seems like a real point in favor of diversity in higher education, that those diverse groups of students are just succeeding at the same task at a higher rate and to a higher level than the non-diverse groups were.
First of all, I think you had an alternative career path in investigative journalism because you were so good at finding people and tracking them down, which terrifies me. I hate cold emails, but that's really impressive. So I wanted to ask you, second of all, obviously this study seems, as you said, to prove that diversity is a good thing and it really helps. But I feel like on some level, institutional racism has convinced us that what you gain in diversity, you lose in merit. And so we don't even stop to look for evidence. Why has that become the status quo that we assume, oh, you're instituting a diversity policy? Well, I guess you're just going to have to sacrifice merit. Why do we think that way?
Yeah, it's a great and important question, and one that we talk about a lot in our article. And you're absolutely right that people who attack affirmative action often try to draw exactly that contrast. They claim by using affirmative action, by pursuing diversity, you are sacrificing merit to some degree. There are lots of people who have said that. We talk a little bit in our article about former President Barack Obama, actually. He was the president of the Harvard Law Review. He was the head person of one of these student-run law journals. And I think when he ran for president, and this became notable, people said, oh, he was only chosen because of affirmative action, and his law review, therefore, was sacrificing merit or quality in order to pick him for diversity reasons. And so, I mean, I think it's the fact that you're looking at something other than test scores and grades or something like that when you're choosing your members. I think some people have it in their head, this idea that merit is just defined by the grades you get and the test scores you get, and that there's no other sort of dimension of merit that might be worthwhile. Or even more to the point that if you're building an institution, you just want to pick all the people with the best grades or all the people who score the highest, and that's your only way of thinking about how to build an institution. And I guess this is a big part of what we wanted to really address in our study. And the counter argument we want to make is, look, when you're building an institution, when you're assembling a group of people to work on something together, you're probably better off not just picking everyone who has the highest test score, you're better off picking a diverse group of people who will bring a diverse group of perspectives to the room. They're going to perform better. That's what we found. And so here, I think the punchline of our study, one way we like to say it, is that diversity and merit are not antagonists, they go hand in hand. Increasing the diversity increases the strength and the performance of the institution.
And I think that over time as well, we have seen, you know, the metrics that colleges weigh their applicants on becomes different. You know, SAT has taken a backseat during the pandemic. Now essays and whatever else are more important. But it seems like people are really stuck on the fact that you can file a case and just go under the secret sauce and you say, well, this person had a higher GPA than this person, but they still weren't admitted. And suddenly that's like the end all be all. But when really there's a lot of people that have a really high SAT score and still don't get admitted somewhere. And I don't know, I feel like there's just a lot of different factors, but you place that GPA out there and suddenly it's clear as day that they should have been admitted. It's weird.
Right, exactly. And schools are, in many cases, taking lots of things into consideration. They think about a person's extracurricular activities. They think about the service work that they've done. They think about whether they play an instrument or whether they play a sport or something like that. They think about whether the person's parents went to the school. So they're admitting the whole person. I think schools understand, like, we want to admit the whole person. We don't just want to admit numbers on tests. And that approach, if someone out there is committed to the view that the number you get on the SAT is a definition of like who you are and how much you deserve to go to a college and how well you're going to perform, then using anything other than that number on the test is going to make that person upset. But I think schools have long understood, the people who actually do this work have long understood, that when you're admitting a class of people, thousands of people, you want to think about the whole person and think about that person in all their different facets and not just focus on one particular number.
So as the high school senior, knowing that this is a podcast for other high schoolers, now going to steer the conversation away from holistic review as we approach November 1st and ask about how do we, knowing that diversity and merit go hand in hand and that diverse institutions really lend themselves to having awesome outcomes, how do we grapple with this idea that there will be an expiration date on affirmative action, according to Justice O'Connor? Like, how do we wrap our heads around that guardrail, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, the Justice O'Connor 25-year timeline, I think, is the least of our concerns right now. The much greater concern is that the court looks very much poised to declare affirmative action unlawful or unconstitutional in this case, this term. And it will probably happen in June. So it will be after the high school class of 2023 is admitted, I guess the college class of 2027. So it will affect the class of 28, 29, et cetera. But it looks really quite probable that the court is going to do this. There are a number of members on the court who have put down their views in writing that they're opposed to affirmative action. And a lot of the members of the court who are newly appointed who have not put down their views are probably going to be opposed. The very fact that the court took the case is usually a strong indication of how it's going to vote. And so we have that indication here. So, I mean, if your question is sort of what happens going forward, my guess would be that colleges and universities are going to try to make backup plans for this, and they're going to try to assemble diverse classes in ways that don't involve looking at race at all. And so they might try to use geography as a way of getting at that question. For instance, we have a lot of residential segregation in America, unfortunately, and so you can often tell what a person's race is just from their zip code, because zip codes tend to be very segregated. And so colleges that looked at geography might be able to get some purchase on diversity. They might look to socioeconomic factors outside of race and try to assemble diverse classes in those ways as well. So I guess what I would say is I think that universities and colleges are probably not going to give up on the mission of assembling diverse classes, because I think they've come to appreciate the value of having diverse classes. But the Supreme Court is in a position to make that a lot harder and make universities not able to do it as well as they would like to. And so things may very well change. The landscape of higher education 5 years from now might look different than it does now today.
And that seems like Justice O'Connor, at least when it comes to diversity, wasn't exactly right in that if we take away the diversity policies, specific policies that say you should consider diversity as a plus factor, we're not going to keep the same diversity. It's like she seemed to think that once we get to a certain point, diversity is just going to be a given and we don't need to keep working for it. But in my mind, diversity seems kind of timeless. You know what I mean? How could the Supreme Court say in June that we're just done with diversity? Like, we achieved it. We did our 25 years and now we're done.
Right. If I tried to reconstruct Justice O'Connor's thinking, what I think that she was getting at was the idea that in 25 years from 2003, so 2028, we would have reached a point of sufficient racial equity in America that institutions of higher education wouldn't need to take race into account specifically in order to have diverse classes, that a diverse class would build itself, even if you weren't ever thinking about how to make it more diverse. And I mean, I think that's a nice aspirational goal that does not appear to be the America we're living in now, and probably won't be the America we're living in 2028 also. It's hard to know exactly what this court is going to say. It might be that this court will just say that diversity is irrelevant. It might be that this court will say that diversity is important, but not important enough to overcome a constitutional barrier. Or it might be that this court will just say the fact of giving certain people advantages by race is so antithetical to the Constitution that it can't be tolerated, even if it's being used for a benign purpose. I mean, I guess one thing that we've sort of circled around but haven't said explicitly is there are really two kind of major ways of thinking about what the Equal Protection Clause is all about and what it means to have equal protection of the laws. One way is what legal scholars call an anti-classification argument, which is like anytime that anyone is being treated differently in any way, shape, or form based on their race, it's unconstitutional. And the other way is what's called an anti-subordination argument, which is the Equal Protection Clause was meant to try to eradicate racial subordination and racial hierarchy in the country. So it should be unlawful to give the most privileged group more advantages, but it shouldn't be unlawful to try to lift up an underprivileged or marginalized group of people. For many, many years, I think the court was implicitly adopting the anti-subordination view, and that's why affirmative action was okay, but like discriminating against African Americans would not have been okay. This particular court seems to have adopted this sort of anti-classification view where any type of differential treatment among the races is unlawful. And that's what's creating this problem. And against that, diversity may just not be a sufficiently powerful reason.
Yeah. Going on then, kind of knowing that on this new court, the Chief Justice sits somewhat in the middle-ish, kind of, depending on the case, where do you expect Justice Roberts to fall along the ideological spectrum when it comes to affirmative action? And like, who are our swing justices, so to speak, in this case?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually think that on this issue, Justice Roberts is less likely to be a swing justice. And the reason is that he was the author of an opinion back in, I believe it's the year 2006. The case is called Parents Involved. And it was about a program in Washington state to try to sort of diversify and really desegregate the Washington public schools. And it was explicitly thinking about race in sort of allocating students, not to higher education, but to high schools, middle schools, et cetera. And again, this was a program that was enacted for an entirely benign and valuable purpose, which is to try to basically break up patterns of racial segregation, which were leading to schools that were sort of segregated by race and more integrate those schools. And Roberts wrote the opinion striking down that program. And he very famously wrote in that opinion, the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And so that's really an embrace of this anti-classification view that we should never under any circumstances treat people differently based on their race. So I think that Roberts is quite likely to vote to strike down affirmative action in this case. If I had to guess who the swing voters are, I would suppose it might be Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett, who I think are not on record on this issue in any substantial way. They're probably the most likely among the six Republican appointed justices to vote in favor of the case, but probably both of them would have to vote to uphold it to sustain affirmative action. And that strikes me as quite unlikely. I think the case is probably more likely to come out 6-3. 6-3 striking down on the affirmative action programs.
So, well, Hannah is class of 2027, I guess, college. I'm class of 2028. What are you telling students? What should we be telling students that are like, I have no idea what affirmative action is going to look like when I am applying to college in 2 years? How should they prepare themselves for that?
Right. I mean, I guess, let's see here. Well, first of all, I think the answer is we just don't know for sure, and we probably won't know until next June after the next school year is over. I'm not sure that sort of advice to students is any different. Like, everyone should just sort of try to be the best student they can be and try to be the best applicant they can be. And I think a recipe for kind of a healthy admissions season, a healthy senior year, is probably just be the best applicant you can be and don't worry too much about the people around you or how you compare to them. But I do think that when students graduate now, I think they all know the world that I'm going out into is going to be different than the world that my parents went into, or maybe even different than the world that my older sisters and brothers walked into. And that's going to be very much true for higher education if affirmative action is struck down. If affirmative action is struck down, the college or university that they head off to will probably be different in some ways than the college or university that their older siblings went to, or maybe that their parents went to. And so people should sort of understand, like, I'm going to have an experience. It's hard to know what that experience will be. We haven't seen that as much, but they should know, like, I might have a different experience. You know, my sister said that this is what college was like. It just might be different for me in various ways.
Yeah, that's interesting, I think, to think about. My brother is 5 years younger than I am. And so we'll see what his experience is like compared to mine. There's a bit of a gap there. We wanted to ask about just kind of going into the cultural political debate around affirmative action and race and diversity. Do you feel that the cultural and political debate kind of around those topics has become divorced from the legal empirical one? And is there a way to kind of separate the two?
It's funny. I actually think exactly the opposite is occurring, which is I think that our cultural debate is being hugely informed by the legal debate. And this gets back to things I said at the beginning. As of 1978, the only permissible reason for having affirmative action was to improve diversity. And that changed not how universities behaved and how they tried to abide by the law, but it changed the way we all talk about affirmative action. And I think that now I'm guessing, you should tell me, but I'm guessing that when you and your friends talk about affirmative action, I mean, certainly when we talk about affirmative action in the context of higher education, we talk about it almost exclusively in terms of diversity and the value of diversity. And that's important. And I think it's good to talk about that. I mean, we have a study showing that we think diversity is important, but I think we could be having an entirely separate or additional national conversation about affirmative action as a tool of trying to achieve racial justice and to remedy past discrimination. And we just don't really have that conversation in a lot of ways because the Supreme Court told us that that's not an acceptable basis for affirmative action. Only diversity is an acceptable basis for affirmative action. So I think that in some ways, the Supreme Court narrowing the law like that has really kind of stultified our national conversation about affirmative action, and that we should be having a much richer conversation. Our social and cultural discussion of affirmative action should be thinking about all these different factors. And it's not as much as I think would be preferable. And that, by the way, probably is bad for the law also, because I wish that the Supreme Court would think about racial justice and about remedying past discrimination as grounds for affirmative action. But the Supreme Court is not going to do that either, because long ago it decided that only diversity mattered.
So it's cyclical. And like the court narrows our window of how we view affirmative action, and then the cultural debate shifts, and so then the legal debate shifts to match the cultural debate, and it never ends.
Right. And it might be, by the way, you know, if the court strikes down affirmative action and sort of throws out diversity, it might be that that will rekindle interest in thinking about affirmative action from a racial justice perspective, and that there will be new sort of good arguments and new kind of good evidence or new good thinking about the value of affirmative action in that regard. And I don't know whether that will have legal effect, but it, at least it might kind of broaden our cultural and social thinking about it. We've been sort of focused with laser-like intensity on diversity for so long now. It would be good to think about other things.
Well, Professor Macer, thank you so much for chatting with us today. And when next June the case comes out, we will very much want to talk to you about it, everything that the court says and how it will shift not only the legal debate, but the cultural and political, everything around affirmative action, because it's such a big deal for high school students, for college students, and we really, really want to talk about that. But thank you so much. First, thank you for today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What a fascinating conversation. We hope you enjoyed listening to Professor Macer as much as we enjoyed talking to him. We are so lucky that he was able to join us and offer his expertise on the nuances of diversity in higher education. The whole point of the series is to give space and a platform to guests like Professor Macer, and we are so happy he came on the podcast.
But it only gets better from here. Our next episode is going to be a conversation with Professor Lisa Stuhlbarg of New York University. She studies the sociology of education and founded her own charter school in Oakland when she was a graduate student. She's an expert on school choice and the push to create diverse schools in aftermath of Brown v. Board of Education. So trust me, you do not want to miss that episode, because it was an amazing conversation.
But for now, before that episode is released, leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com. We can't wait to see you next time.